Good evening, everyone. My name is Andrew Fracknoy. I'm the Emeritus Professor of Astronomy here at Foothill College in Los Altos, and it's a pleasure for me to welcome everyone here in the Smithwick Theater and everyone listening to us on the web to this lecture in the 24th Annual Silicon Valley Astronomy Lectures. This series of public programs is jointly sponsored by the Foothill College Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Division, by the SETI, or Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, which is headquartered in Mountain View, and the Venerable Astronomical Society of the Pacific, which is in San Francisco. And we really appreciate their help in getting the word out about this series. We have a tradition of speakers explaining astronomical topics at the frontiers of our understanding in everyday language, and I'm delighted to introduce our speaker tonight, Professor Jessica Liu. She received her undergraduate degree in physics from MIT. She worked as a software engineer in Silicon Valley for 3 years before returning to academia to pursue a PhD in astronomy. And she got that at UCLA. She was awarded a Millikan postdoctoral fellowship in observational astronomy at Caltech and was also an NSF postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Astronomy at the University of Hawaii. Eventually, she joined the faculty there. In 2016, she came to University of California, Berkeley, where she joined the faculty in the astronomy department, and where today she is currently an associate professor of astronomy and also chair of the Department of Astronomy. She grew up, she tells me, as an avid ballet dancer in Texas, and she has danced her way into the California area. And she's also an avid user of what is one of the largest telescopes in the world, the Keck telescope in Hawaii, up at 14,000 feet. So she has had experience of the earth and the skies, and it's a real pleasure for me to introduce to you Professor Jessica Liu.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction and very much for the invitation to come and talk to you all tonight. That Keck Observatory that I was just that you heard just mentioned is actually here. It's two telescopes situated there, and those lasers are real, and we'll talk about where those come into our story in a little bit. So tonight I'm going to tell you about finding black holes in our own Milky Way galaxy and tell you a little about the technologies we use to find those black holes. But let's start at the beginning. What is a black hole? I think we've had enough movies now showing you what black holes can look like. Here's an artist's rendition, this is not an astronomical picture, of a black hole that is warping the space-time around it and lensing or bending the light from background stars and galaxies. So that may be what a black hole would look like if we could get up close to one. It might be a little dangerous, but it's still possible. What does it mean physically, though? Well, black holes are relatively simple and also infinitely complex. A black hole represents the limit of our understanding of physics today. We think of a black hole at the center is fundamentally a singularity. That means a point at which the mathematics that we know about that describes the universe breaks, and we can't understand it. Black holes have relatively simple properties. They represent if you take some volume and you pack some mass into it, at that point, the density becomes infinite. So it's mass over zero volume. Just keep shrinking the volume down and down and down of anything, and you can get a black hole. A penny, a sun, a whole galaxy. Black holes' properties are few. They have mass. They have this thing called event horizon, which fundamentally is the what we think of as the radius or the size of the black hole. If you cross over the event horizon, you can't get back out again. You can't, neither can light. That's what a black hole has. So in addition to mass, black holes also can have spin, we think, but I won't talk much more about spin today. So all of this is largely from theory. So let's talk about the theory of black holes. There's a couple of different varieties of black holes. One is what we would call ordinary black holes, in double quotes. These ordinary black holes are the fate of massive stars. When a star that's much more massive than our own sun, something like 20 or 30 times the mass of the sun, when it dies, it exhausts its fuel at its core, it collapses, and it can become a black hole, but the black hole that you form is smaller. You usually collapse and die violently, maybe through a supernova explosion. Much of the mass is thrown off, but what is left collapses into this ordinary black hole. These were first predicted by theory, in fact, and we think we have somewhere between 100 million and a billion of these ordinary black holes floating around in our Milky Way galaxy. Just to give you some context, there's about 100 billion stars in our galaxy, so something like 1% of all the objects we think in our galaxy are probably these invisible black holes. That number, though, you see, it's an order of magnitude uncertain. We don't know if it's 100 million or a billion. There's another variety of black hole called a supermassive black hole. These are the kinds of black holes that you find at the hearts of galaxies, including our own Milky Way. Their masses are much higher, something like a million to a billion suns, not a few or 10 suns like the previous ordinary ones we talked about. Interestingly, these were not predicted by theory. They were first seen observationally. At the centers of many distant galaxies, you would find this bright, variable object called a quasar, and it turns out the only thing that can make something that bright and vary that fast was a supermassive black hole eating up gas from its surroundings. These days, we think there's a supermassive black hole almost in every galaxy we look in, we can find one. And I won't talk much more about supermassive black holes until almost the very end of the talk, because they are so well observationally studied. I think the ordinary black holes that we talked about are actually more at the frontier today. Even though there should be more of them and closer to us, we know of none up until last year. Okay, so how do we find black holes? This is a fantastic picture of the Keck Observatory, and this two twin 10-meter telescopes on the top of a mountain in Hawaii with beautiful conditions, but even such a beautiful telescope needs some help making sharp images of the universe. And we'll need those sharp images throughout the rest of this talk to find these black holes. So black holes are hard to find. Why? They're stellar ghosts. They have no light of their own. There's no signpost that says, I'm here, I'm a black hole. If you went and looked right at a black hole, you wouldn't see very much at all. So what do we do? Well, there are some ways to probe black holes. The first is you can see them. You're not actually seeing the black hole. What you can see is if the black hole has a companion star that it orbits around, or the star orbits around the black hole, and it's donating mass or spilling over mass onto the black hole, that accretion of gas, as the gas shrinks down and goes into the event horizon, it glows very brightly. So that's one way we can see black holes, but they have to have a binary companion star that's giving it mass. These days, in a very exciting technological development, we can also hear black holes. Now, this isn't hearing in real radio waves. This is hearing the ringing of space-time itself when two stellar mass black holes orbit and then merge. They actually produce ripples in space-time. Those ripples in space-time can now be measured with gravitational wave observatories like LIGO and Kagra and Virgo. You may have heard of some of those. So they leave this little ripple that looks a lot like a little sound wave, as you can see on the bottom, and that's the signpost of merging black holes, not in our own galaxy, but in distant galaxies. We found the first of these around 5 years ago. Now there's more than 100 that are known. So that has 100-fold increased our sample of ordinary black holes in the universe, but almost all of them, in fact, all of these black holes that we can hear are not in our own Milky Way. Here's the census of all the black holes that we know about, the stellar mass ordinary black holes that we know about, in blue. So the vertical axis on this plot tells you the mass. Those numbers are a little bit hard to see, and so I can try to turn on a pointer and show you right here. This is 50 solar masses, 50 times the mass of the sun going across like that. And down here is 5 times the mass of the sun. So these black holes are big, right? The vast majority of these shown in blue are those ordinary black holes that merge and produce those gravitational wave signals. The ones that are in pink here are the ones that we know about that have a companion star that we're dumping mass onto it. And everything that's in yellow on the bottom is what we call a neutron star. It's not actually a black hole. It's the result of a slightly less massive star collapsing. So this is a lovely diagram. The butterfly effect is just here to make it look nice. This axis here doesn't mean anything. So that's a nice census, but everything in blue is outside the Milky Way. Everything in pink is inside the mostly inside the Milky Way. All of them are binaries. They all have companions of one kind or another. So that's fine. That's great. That's a fantastic sample of black holes. What can we say about black holes from that sample? Unfortunately, not a lot. So there are a lot of unknown questions. First off, I said we don't know how many black holes there are in the Milky Way. That's because we've only found maybe a half dozen all in binaries in our own galaxy. We think the vast majority of black holes are single, isolated, free-floating, alone. We also don't even know which stars turn into black holes. That sample that I showed you is too small. We don't think it's representative of the normal black holes that are out there. It's just the rare ones that have these close by companion stars. So there's a lot we don't know about which stars will actually make black holes in the long run when they die. What is the black hole mass distribution? I showed you there are black holes of 5 solar masses and 50. Are there more 5s than 50s? Are there more 50s than 5s? Are there black holes even more massive than that and even less massive than that? That's one thing we still don't know. How many black holes are in binaries? And when will they merge? Without finding this free-floating single ones, we can't say much about how often they become binary systems. Do black holes, when they are formed, get kicked? When that supernova occurs, it's a pretty violent reaction. You can imagine the black hole flying off into space, or it might just sit there. We don't actually know. And finally, I won't talk about this too much, but if you're a fan of dark matter or string theory, we have a big open question about whether primordial black holes exist. These would be black holes born at the beginning of the universe, in the phase of expansion, rapid expansion right after the Big Bang. Some of the densest parts of the universe might have formed primordial black holes then. These are entirely speculative, the realm of mathematics at the moment, but doesn't mean we shouldn't look for them anyways. Okay, so we have lots of reasons to go out and look for free-floating black holes, not black holes just in binaries like we have for the last 30 years. So how do we do this? As I said, free-floating black holes are going to be pretty hard to find. They're going to be dark. They don't have much light themselves. But it turns out they are numerous. So if you just do a little exercise for me, hold your hand out and put your thumb out. You might be familiar with this exercise. That thumb is about the size of the moon, the full moon, when you're up in the sky. If you put this towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy when you go out at night and you see the swath of the Milky Way going by, and you put your thumb up there, you're going to have about 150 black holes behind your thumb. So why are they so hard to find? There's so many of them. So here's a little patch on the sky. This little patch, if you're an observer, this is about 20 arc seconds on the sky. This is 1/100th the size of the full moon, so it's a tiny little patch. And this is from simulations. You can see there are many, many, many stars. Those are in gray. There's many white dwarfs in pink and neutron stars in yellow, and maybe there's one black hole in this size of a patch. So the problem is there's a lot of stars, a lot of starlight that is masquerading and masking our view of whether or not that black hole is there. That's both a pro and a con. So those black holes, the stars that are there are shining, they're shining brightly. Maybe it makes it hard to find a black hole, but on the flip side, there's a fairly good chance that this black hole, as it moves across the sky, might run over one of these stars, pass in front of it. And that's the activity that we're looking for, because it can cause a signal called gravitational lensing. You may be familiar with lensing. This is a wine glass, the bottom of a wine glass. If you've ever held up a glass in front of a light source, like a candle, so here you have this nice candle, it's making a bright point for you. But when you make an image of that candle through the lens, suddenly you see multiple candles. There aren't multiple candles there. Really what you're doing is you're taking the light from the candle that would normally go away from your eye and you bend it back towards us and it makes that three, in this case, three images of the candle. It can get even more extreme. Here's one with two images of the candle. Here's one with a candle turned into a ring. All of this is lensing. Our glass at the bottom of this wine glass is just acting as a lens. A black hole can do the same thing. It can bend the space-time around it and cause the light of a background star to bend and warp and make a ring or make multiple images. And that's the signpost. If we could see that effect, we would know that there is something doing lensing in front of the star. A black hole, but it could be not just a black hole. It could be a neutron star, a white dwarf, an exoplanet, or another star. We see this gravitational lensing at work in the universe. This is not lensing by a black hole, but lensing by a whole galaxy. So here is a galaxy. Both of these are galaxies. This is actually two galaxies, one in the foreground, which is in the middle. Its gravity, it's closer to us, and its gravity is warping space-time, and the background galaxy shown in blue is actually imaged multiple times. It got warped and wrapped around the galaxy, and now we see multiple copies of the background galaxy. Pretty cool, huh? This is a real Hubble Space Telescope image, right? This is no longer artist's rendition. So these are both examples of lensed galaxies. Now, when it comes to gravitational lensing, galaxies are amazing because they're so big, we can actually see and resolve these separate images. We see them as distinct. Unfortunately, stellar mass black holes are so tiny that we aren't going to be able to, even with the biggest telescope in the world or the biggest telescope we can imagine in the next 100 years, we won't be able to resolve these. That's going to be a problem for finding free-floating stellar mass black holes. But let's go back to an artist's rendition, right? So I said, if you can get close enough, here's that black hole doing its gravitational lensing, not of one background star, but of the whole Milky Way, artist's rendition again, right? So if this could get as close as the nearest star, this is the kind of thing we might see. So now let's look at this from a little simpler perspective. A single background star's light rays will come off. Normally, they would pass away from our telescope. We would only see the light ray coming straight on towards us from the center. But now these light rays get bent back around by the black hole, which is in the foreground. We make those multiple images, and we see them on the sky. Now, a key thing to remember is that image is not where the background star is. It would look like the background star was way up here and way down here, but in fact, it's in the middle. Now, as I said, we can't resolve these multiple images, these lensed images. All we see is a single star. The whole time, it just looks like a single star. But temporarily, that star will look like it gets brighter, and it will also look like it has a little shift. And I'll show you a position on the sky, and I'll show you what that looks like in just a minute. So even if we can't resolve it, we still might be able to use this lensing effect as a signpost that a black hole is there. Okay, here's the fun animation. So this is a black hole, again close, zoomed up, and this is a background star. And as we go forward, that background star passes by, everything in the galaxy is moving. You see the two images wrap around, and then it goes on its happy way. So now I'm going to replay this picture. Look at the two plots on the bottom this time. So as the background star gets gravitationally lensed, you see the brightness increase, and you see the position on the sky no longer look like a straight line. It has this funny little mustache effect. That's what we're looking for. These two measurements in combination, the change in brightness, which we call gravitational microlensing, because we can't resolve the images, we just see the brightness change, and this position change, we need both of these together to say, yes, there is something doing lensing, and yes, it is massive enough to be a black hole. Remember, black holes aren't the size of our sun. They're many times as massive as our sun. Okay, so here's now a view, again, showing the effect of the brightening. And now here is the black hole going by and the two images that you would see. So this is just a scientific version of what we saw before. That's the brightening signal that we're looking for. Now, if we measure only the brightening signal, so if you go out and look at a million stars and you see one get brighter and fade away, you might say, I found a black hole. But in fact, you don't know. It could be a black hole, or it could be a star, or it could be a brown dwarf, or a white dwarf, or a planet. All of those things can have this same effect. They can make this temporary brightening. So this photometry or brightness alone doesn't tell us anything about the mass of that lensing object. It doesn't tell us if it's big enough to be a black hole. That's where the position measurements come in. So now here's an animation showing the position. So the lens, or the black hole in our case, is this little blue thing here that's wobbling back and forth just a little bit. It's wobbling because the Earth goes around the sun and our perspective changes. We call that parallax. And the star, the background star, is going by in green. And I'll play this one again. So it's going by, zooming by at pretty fast speed. It has a little wobble itself. You can just barely see it. Again, Earth going around the sun, parallax. Those two images that get made are shown in yellow. So they go by. You see one goes off to the top, and then one wraps down around the bottom. And if you sum those two images up, and you don't resolve it, you can't get a sharp image and see both. All you do is you see the sum of both of them. That's what's shown in red. So this red curve is the position that we would actually measure. So we'll play that one more time. So if we're just measuring the star and watching it go along its way, and suddenly it has this little perturbation right there, that's the size that we're looking for, then we can measure that offset and we can actually make a measurement of the mass of the lensing object. That says gives mass info right down there. Now the problem is, this is simulation still, here's what it might look like. So we expect a star to move in a roughly straight line, except for that parallax, and then it should take this little deviation that we should see. The size of this deviation is, in astronomy units, it's about 1 milliarcsecond for a black hole. What does that mean? Well, if you could see someone blinking on the moon, the movement of their eyelashes would be the equivalent of 1 milliarcsecond measurement. That's pretty hard to do, right? Even with their visors up on their spacesuit helmets, they have to blink, and you have to be able to say they're blinking 10 times a second or 50 times a second. That's the measurement that we're trying to make. So it is very technically challenging. So just remember that 1 milliarcsecond unit of measure is one eye blink worth of distance at the moon. Okay, so the cool thing is this astrometric shift or position shift that I was just talking about, the blinking, what we're looking for for a black hole, the measurement is close to 1 milliarcsecond. Everything does this though. If it's a star or a neutron star, this is a star down here like the sun. If a sun were to do it, it also perturbs background light of its stars. Let's say there's a sun out there and it moves in front of some other distant background star. It too will gravitationally lens. It will make the background star brighter. It will make the background star look like it wobbles on the sky, takes that little excursion. But the scale of it is much, much smaller. So here we go. We know what we need to do. We need to measure the brightening, and we need to measure this astrometric shift, the position shift. And the bigger the position shift, the bigger the mass. And for this case, this is a 10 solar mass black hole. Okay, so we have all the tools in place. There's only one problem. We got to wait for a black hole to pass in front of a star. How often does that happen? Well, it's a pretty rare phenomenon. So here we are in our Milky Way galaxy. We're out here in the suburbs of the galaxy, in Earth. There's the center of the galaxy. Some local black hole may be moving by, and the background light from a very distant star, usually towards the center of the Milky Way, towards the center of the galaxy, will come by and be bent and warped by the black hole. That's the event that we're looking for. But they have to be very well aligned. And so how often does that occur? Well, we can maximize our chances by looking towards crowded fields where there's lots of stars. More stars means more chance to get a black hole crossing. And we do that. We have all kinds of surveys that are out there looking at whole patches of the Milky Way. This is the Ogle survey, and everything you see in color here is surveyed every single night, maybe 50 times a night. They'll be taking measurements of those stars, and it's probably about 100 million stars that they're surveying. So that's pretty good. We can hope to see in 100 million stars in a year, we can hope to see about 200 microlensing events, 200 to 500 microlensing events. That's not bad. Are all those black holes? Sadly, no. Only 1% of those might be black holes. So of the 200 microlensing events that they find, maybe one or two are going to be black holes. So we really are looking for a needle in a haystack. Here's what some good black hole candidates look like. These are just from the photometric, the brightness changes that we were talking about. So we see the brightening, that's good. These are real data now from that Ogle project that I was just talking about. And these are some of the best black hole candidates that we had that we started observing in 2018. This one's 2019 over here. So you can see the quality of the data is pretty good, but not great. It's not perfect. If you've ever seen data from Kepler or TESS or a space telescope, it's exquisite. No, this is your backyard telescope, run-of-the-mill. Well, it's actually a 2-meter telescope, but it's a little bit bigger than our backyard. But still, we can see our error bars here are decently large. In some cases, we don't have really great data coverage because the sun got in the way. But, you know, this is what we have to work with. Okay, so these microlensing events, they go off. One thing I wanted to point out is the scale here. This is days. So this is 7,600 days, 8,400 days. So the delta here is about 1,000 days. So the time scale of this event is 100 days. So that's quite a long event. This is not a fast action. Now, I said there are 200 or 300 microlensing events that happen every year. How do we know which ones are going to be good black holes? We have to make simulations to guess first, to inform our choices. So we spent a lot of time making mock Milky Ways in our computer. We make a mock galaxy, we put in 100 billion stars, and we put in 100 million black holes, and we let them all move. And we wait for them to cross in our computer, and then we say, okay, how often do they cross? And when they do, and they make these microlensing events, what makes the black holes different from everything else? So this is simulation, not real data. And we have two things that we looked at in our simulations. We said, okay, let's look for that position offset. Remember, we were looking for that big shift in the position that tells us that it's a black hole. So that's position offset here. And then this is the time scale, the duration of the microlensing event, how long it lasts. So everything in the simulation here, the stars are in green, white dwarfs are in blue, and the black holes are in black. So what you can see right away is the black holes like to have long durations compared to everything else, right? So that was the key. The key is not to look at all 200 or 300 of those microlensing events every year, but to just look at the ones that were longest. Find the longest duration microlensing events, the ones that take the longest amount of time, and only start to measure those, and then you'll have a better shot of finding a black hole. Otherwise, it's a 1 in 200 chance. By only focusing on things that are longer than 100 days, this is 100 days right here, that's 10 days there, and 1 day over here, by only focusing on things with 100 days, we have about a 50-50 chance of getting a black hole, at least when we set out to do this experiment, which was 10 years ago. So this tells you how to look for the photometry, the brightening signal. What about that astrometry or position signal? The same telescopes, unfortunately, can't tell us that position measurement. They can tell us whether a star gets brighter or not, but those telescopes tend to be small. Their images are blurry because of the turbulence of the Earth's atmosphere. And so we're stuck with very blurry images where we can't precisely measure positions. Instead, we have to turn to two possible resources that give us much, much better image quality. One is the Hubble Space Telescope. Go to space and you get clear images, even with a small telescope. And by the way, Hubble's a small telescope. It's only 2.4 meters. Or two, we go to the biggest telescopes in the world, the Keck observatories, at least biggest in the optical and the infrared. The Keck observatories are great, but they still suffer from all that atmospheric turbulence that's blurring the images. But we are clever. We can equip them with something called adaptive optics, which I'll talk a lot about later. That's what these lasers are for. And with this adaptive optics, we can beat the blurring of the Earth's atmosphere. We can correct it in real time and get back to our super sharp images. And so that's what we've done. We've selected a bunch of black hole candidates from those photometric surveys I was talking about earlier, the long duration ones. And right at the peak, when we know how long they're going to last, we say these are good black hole candidates, and we start observing them with the Hubble Space Telescope and with the Keck Observatory. And we look for that position measurement. We first started this project back in 2011, so it's been a little while. These take a long time. Remember I said it's 1,000 days. So here was a pilot survey, the very first time we attempted this. Here is an example of the microlensing event. This is the actual microlensing event we first started observing. And we hopped onto it right around here, and we measured it from here, and then we measured it for another 6 years. And here's what we saw. Remember, we're looking for something that doesn't look like a straight line. Does that look like a straight line to you? It's pretty straight, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty straight. That's, we thought so too, so we declared this a non-detection, but fortunately, what we could say is that even though it was a microlensing event and a long duration and a straight line, we could get a mass out. Sorry, it's cut off on the bottom. This is the mass on this axis here, and the numbers here, this is one solar mass right here. This is 0.2 solar masses. So we could say that the mass range had to be between 0.2 and 1 solar mass. It definitely was not a black hole. But what it could do is tell us that we can show, if we had a black hole, we could have proved that it was a black hole. So while it's a non-detection, we thought it was a successful demonstration and we were ready to invest more telescope time in this kind of project. And fortunately, all of our telescope time allocation committees agreed with us. They and the NSF agreed with us and gave us funding and more telescope time to keep at the project. And thankfully they did, because just 2 years ago in 2022, we used the Hubble Space Telescope this time to monitor 5 black hole candidates, and we found one black hole, the very first one, that's free floating in the Milky Way. So here's a picture of Hubble in space. That's a real picture from another satellite, or from ISS. And here's our picture that Hubble took. And I'm going to show it as a movie, because remember, we're taking multiple images over time. So these are the real data. And so here you're watching it, and you see it flares up and it drops down. Now, this the pictures on top is actually from OGLE, actually, the ground-based telescope. So played again, you can see it's a clear microlensing event. Here's that background star. It gets brighter for a time and fades away, and it's just sitting there flat for a long time after that. So that's the brightness that change that we measured. And we hopped onto it again right at the peak. We started observing with Hubble, and here's what we saw. Now remember, we're looking for things that don't look like straight lines. This gets really hard though, because we're looking for blinking eyelashes. Okay, so there's our data and our measurements, and the model is shown in red that fits the data the best. Now, if you just saw this in this plot, would you say that's a straight line or not? Really, really hard to tell, right? Okay, well, let me give you a better view. Let's get rid of, strip out entirely the straight line motion, and let's just look at the residuals after the fact. Okay, so that's what we're showing down on the bottom. Here's the position in the east-west direction on the sky. Here's the position in the north-south direction on the sky as a function of time. And again, these are in days. So this is 56,000 to 60,000. This span here is 4,000 days. So we looked at this thing for 10 years. It took us 10 years to find this thing. Okay, so now, if it were moving in a straight line, all of these points would be at zero and straight across. So this one, yeah, it doesn't look super straight. It's a little wobbly. But this one is definitely not a straight line. That thing takes a huge dip in the beginning, right during the microlensing event, and then comes back up and is kind of straight afterwards. That's exactly what we were looking for. And notice the scale here is about 1 milliarcsecond. One eyelash blink, which is exactly what we were looking for a stellar mass black hole as well. So in fact, with lots of hard work and analysis, we took those data that you just saw, and we could weigh this lens, this thing that was moving in the foreground in front of that background star, and we could determine that it was 6 times more massive than our own sun. We could also determine that it was dark. It had no light of its own. So those two things taken together, 6 times as massive as the sun and no light, tells us it can be only one thing, and that's a stellar mass black hole. There were no signs of a companion star, and so indeed we found the first free-floating stellar mass black hole in the Milky Way. We haven't stopped. We've been doing a larger sample of objects, and I want to put this back into context of those simulations. Remember I said we were making mock Milky Ways in our computer? And we had all kinds of interesting things we can do with the simulations, and we can compare that to our observations. The one in black, so all the contours that you see are objects we've been measuring, their masses, seeing their microlensing events, and we can then measure their masses with the astrometry. This one in black is the black hole that I just introduced you to. And so you can see how they relate compared to all the simulations, which are the points in the back. So first, we can talk about the time scale of the event. How long did it take? That's this duration axis. And then you see that all of our candidates, we did indeed pick things that were long in duration, more than 100 days. We looked at five altogether, and only one ended up being a black hole, but it was the one with the longest duration event that we picked. So that makes sense to us. There's also a lot of information we can get from the shape of the light curve, especially what we call parallax effects. And so that helps divide, again, stars away from black holes. The black hole that we found is maybe a little on the edge of the cloud, but you can see there's some simulated black holes that kind of fall in the same region too. So in the end, we have completed this sample of five. We have another 10 candidates that are in the works. And don't tell anyone, but I think we have some more black holes in there. Oops, we're on video, I think. Okay, so the nice thing is, even from one measurement, we can already help inform those questions that I posed in the beginning, the questions that we want to answer as astrophysicists. Right now, our detection rate of one out of these five is consistent with there being about 200 million black holes in the Milky Way. And if you take that number and project it, that means the nearest black hole to us should be about 80 light years away. That's not the one we found, of course, but it just gives you a sense of the density of black holes. There's a lot of them floating around out there. And now we can update our complete census of galactic black holes. So I showed you the chart before, the butterfly plot, if you remember, with all the blue points. But now I've zoomed into just the ones in our own galaxy. Most of them are in binaries. That's these red ones and green ones and orange ones and purple ones out here. All of those are those binary black holes. And here is our one, the first isolated black hole. So our hope is to populate this plot with many, many more free-floating black holes in the next 10 years or so. Okay, so I want to spend the last little bit of time talking about so not only the questions that remain, but also the technologies we're developing to try and improve our ability to answer those questions. So just to come back, that total number of black holes, we're making reasonably good progress there. We have a much better constraint than we used to, but all of these other questions still remain. So how are we going to answer those? Well, we need a much bigger sample of black holes. How are we going to do that? What's our next in our search for black holes? We can keep doing the same thing we're doing, but where's the fun in that? It's slow going. It's 10 years for every one black hole. So it's time to improve things. The first thing is we can get better photometry. So that's the first thing. We have to find these microlensing events, and they're rare. So what can we do? Well, we can, instead of using one ground-based telescope to survey this region, we can change our approach entirely. We can go to space and improve the error bars on all the photometry, and we can use not one telescope, but many telescopes to survey all the sky, ideally, or large fractions of the sky simultaneously. So we're working on a novel concept for a small constellation of CubeSats. This is a telescope about yay big, so a little bit bigger than a bread box, about the size of a microwave. And each one of these telescopes would be equipped with a telescope that you can see here. We would fly them in an orbit around Earth, close to Earth, just like Hubble, but kind of in a string of pearls configuration. And so this telescope is looking out here, this telescope's looking out here, they orbit around and they jump into the fields of view. So if you're looking for a microlensing event, you have nice continuous coverage of those microlensing events the whole day, the whole month, and for almost all of the year, except for about 2 or 3 months when it goes behind the sun. So this kind of concept is good for all kinds of time domain or transient phenomena out there in the universe, not just black hole gravitational lensing, but also supernovae, rare transient phenomena. And what's really neat about this concept of a space constellation of satellites is you can take all of these existing surveys that are out there. The one that's closest to Ogle is probably this pink point here. These are all other sky surveys. Here's how sensitive they are. So the more sensitive they are, the higher up they go. And then here's how much area they can cover all at once, simultaneously. And that constellation that I just mentioned, even if we only had three satellites, it would produce this point here, And if we could do 150 satellites, it would go over here. So we can cover much more area. That means many more stars and many more transient events, many more microlensing events, and therefore many more black holes, and with better photometry to boot. I said this kind of curious project can do many types of science. Gravitational lensing is just one thing it can do, including black holes, supernovae, exoplanets, follow-up of merging gravitational wave events, all kinds of fun science to be done with such a telescope. And for the techies out there, if you are an amateur astronomer, here's that size. Here's the rendering of the telescope, just for fun. There's the telescope itself. This is sandwiched, a big solid piece of glass, all sandwiched together. So think of it like one piece of glass, and you coat the backside, and you carve out the front side, and the light comes through here, bounces off there, bounces off here, and then goes down there. So that's our telescope, all in one piece of glass, pretty cool. We have to have a deployable star shade that jets out so it can block all the sunlight and starlight that might like sunlight and earthlight that likes to come into the telescope. Our camera with the detector is back here. This is everything you need to keep a satellite flying in a stable orbit, and lots of solar panels to keep the whole thing powered. So this is a really fun project we've been working on. We're trying to get NASA to fund it now. If you want to know more, you're welcome to ask questions. But what I'm most excited about this kind of capability for gravitational lensing is, remember I said we can learn a lot by measuring the shapes of those microlensing light curves? So here is an example of what we can learn from the shapes. Here's a microlensing event. This is a simulation. And if you look, there are subtle differences between the brown and the green. The brown and the green. They're very, very tiny differences. But they're what tell us whether something is a black hole in green or a star in brown. Those very subtle shape differences, if we could measure them, could tell us a lot just from the photometry alone without having to do those expensive measurements with Hubble and Keck in the meantime. So that would be better photometry. That's something we're aiming to do. But we're also interested in better astrometry, those position measurements, which are so critical to weighing the lens. So with that, we go back to the Keck or Hubble Space Telescopes, or even better, a whole new facility that we're working on. The Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope is going to be a new telescope launched in 2027 by NASA. It's actually the same size as Hubble in terms of its collecting area, but you can see its field of view, the number of detectors that it has behind the scenes, is so much bigger than Hubble. There's Hubble's picture taking capability. Here's Roman's picture taking capability. So what's really neat is with Roman, we're going to do a microlensing survey, a gravitational lensing survey, aimed at finding exoplanets with Roman. And we're going to hijack it and have it find black holes too. So we're really excited about that. And what's cool with Roman is you get that photometry, the brightening, and astrometry, the position measurements, with the same telescope at the same time. Okay, not only Roman, we want to eventually be able to resolve those two images. Remember back in the early slides I said gravitational lensing takes one star and turns it into two? We would love to just see the two stars. That would be instantaneous proof. We could make an instantaneous measurement and say if it was a black hole or not. But to do that, we need way sharper images than we currently get today. That means bigger telescopes. So the only place we can really build bigger telescopes is on the ground, not in space. It's way hard to build big telescopes in space. James Webb Space Telescope is 6.4 meters. The next big generation telescope, which is called Habitable Worlds Observatory, is also 6.4 meters. We're not planning to build a bigger one yet. So Keck, comparatively speaking, is 10 meters. We're already bigger on the ground than in space, and we're thinking of 30-meter telescopes, which I'll show you in a minute. So that's great. Let's do it on the ground, except for that pesky atmosphere. Our beautiful starlight travels 20,000 light years, only to be distorted right at the very last millisecond. Okay, so I talked about these, what happens from the blurring effects of the atmosphere. Here's a nice Hubble image above the atmosphere. Here's what that same object looks like from the ground. Pretty nasty. But I mentioned these adaptive optics systems, and what those, this is a blurry image taken from the ground. You can see the atmospheric turbulence is doing all kinds of crazy things to this thing that's supposed to be a single star. So we do this cool thing with adaptive optics where we take that star's distorted wavefront through the atmosphere, We make a measurement of that wavefront with a wavefront sensor. We correct it in real time with a really cool thin deformal mirror that's going like this 1,000 times a second, and actually reshaping the wavefront of light to make it flat again, or as flat as we can get it. And then finally, we take the corrected light and send it back down to our science camera, and hopefully we get a sharp image as a result. So here's a really cool animation of AO system in action. So the distorted incoming wavefront of light, the DM, and this is the picture that it would make, the DM reshapes things going like that. Here's after the correction, and there's the corrected image. Right, so night and day, big, fat, blurry, yucky image, nice, sharp image there. So that's a simulation, and we can show you what this looks like with a real telescope, but I have to introduce you to one more technology, and that is we need a star to make the measurement of the wavefront in the first place. And that star has to be bright at optical wavelengths. But what if we want to look towards the center of the galaxy where there's lots of dust? Remember I said we wanted to look towards the center where there's lots of stars, but that dust makes it hard to find a guide star. That's where the lasers come in. We can make fake stars in the sky. It's pretty cool. So we shine a sodium laser up into the atmosphere. This is not what we don't want to use this. We want to make a fake star up there. So fortunately for us, micrometeorites are constantly raining down onto Earth, and they burn up in the upper atmosphere, and they deposit all kinds of sodium atoms, and the sodium atoms filter down, and when they hit about 90 kilometers above the ground, the sodium atoms become neutral. We can shine a laser up at that point to that altitude and excite those neutral sodium atoms. And when they are done being excited, their electrons settle back down and they emit photons and they glow and they make a fake star. And that layer of neutral sodium is very thin, so it makes a star just at that one altitude. It shines, excites the sodium atoms just at that one altitude. Hence, we have a laser guide star made at the sodium thanks to all those micrometeorites. Pretty fun. Okay, and this has a local Bay Area connection. Sodium laser guide stars were actually invented in the Bay Area at Lawrence Livermore National Labs. Claire Max, shown here in this picture, this is one of the very first laser guide stars used on the sky for astronomy, is shown here in the picture. She's one of the inventors of this technology. And here's the real deal. These are real images taken now with the Keck telescope without adaptive optics and with adaptive optics. In this case, this is taken at the very center of our galaxy. This is the galactic center without AO and with AO. So you can see what a difference it makes, and that this kind of science in these crowded fields would just simply not be possible without sharp, sharp images from adaptive optics. So I'm going to go through that. So we are working on all kinds of cool improvements. AO is fantastic. We can put it on big telescopes, but it has its limitations. It can do a really good job of correcting over a small field of view, but it really, the correction degrades pretty fast as you go away from your guide star. So we're trying to improve that with next generation adaptive optics systems that do much better, things that work in the visible light, and I'll keep you posted. But even past that, we can build even now bigger telescopes, a 30-meter telescope. Here's the Keck mirror. Here's the next-generation planned 30-meter telescope, or the Europeans are working on a 39-meter telescope, also equipped with adaptive optics. And here's why we're excited. Here's simulation now, showing where we are today with Keck, even if we spend a lot of money and upgrade Keck where we might get, and then what we can get with a 30-meter. And this is an animation, so I'll show you if this plays. There we go. So you can see why building a bigger telescope is of such interest to astronomers. Those sharp images can suddenly allow us to measure the motions of stars that we couldn't even see before, measure them much more precisely. And in our case for these stellar mass black holes that are gravitationally lensing, hopefully start to resolve those multiple images. All right, so I'm going to finish there, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Very nice presentation. Thank you very much. So basically, you distinguish this occlusion event by brightness and distance. So, length of the event, the longer it is, that's the black hole. And then you also look at the, I didn't quite understand about the mass. How do you calculate the mass from that picture? But actually my question was, if you look at the black hole, let's say in the infrared, but what if you look simultaneously in, let's say, visible X-ray, maybe in infrared and very far infrared, then from the dispersion of the space, you can get some additional information. I want to ask your thoughts about that.
Yeah, great question, thank you. So first off, I showed this plot, which is the duration, how long the event lasts. This is the astrometry, the size of the signal. So the problem is if you look at just the duration, it could be a black hole or it could be something else, a star. So that's not enough. You need the astrometry. So you need that positional offset to say a big positional offset, that's a black hole because it's long and big positional offset. Whereas if you have no positional offset, then it's probably a star.
So but you say like the mass, if it's five times?
Yep.
Solar mass, that's the black hole. If it's like once, it's not.
Yep,
so,
but we can't measure the mass directly. What the mass is proportional to this positional offset directly. So if we measure this, this positional offset is a third of the mass, basically. Yeah, so there's a nice relationship between that and the mass. So that's how we measure the mass. In terms of measuring at other wavelengths, unfortunately, gravitational lensing of light at the scale that we're talking about, it bends all the light the same way. It's an achromatic effect. It doesn't have really much of a color term. So there's not enough to see the color change based on this gravitational lensing. If you got right behind the black hole, maybe, but that almost never happens. You're usually moving slightly above or below the black hole, far enough away to not have a detectable color change.
But also there is a delay, so different wavelengths come at different times.
Yeah, so even that effect is too small. Maybe if you had a variable star behind you that was oscillating really fast, you could do it, like a pulsar or something. So if we lensed a pulsar, maybe, but we haven't found one of those either yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure.
Professor, at the beginning of your talk, you said that black holes might have fin, or did you say spin?
Spin, yeah.
Spin. Thank you. Well, my other question is, the write-up for tonight's talk says only about two dozen, and you say 27, black holes are confidently known in our galaxy. All of them are in binary systems where they orbit a living star. Why is it that in every case it's the black hole that orbits the living star, and in no case is it the reverse?
Yeah, so as astronomers, we think about the universe from a special relativity standpoint. Einstein's birthday is tomorrow, this is appropriate. We can talk about the star orbiting the black hole or the black hole orbiting the star equivalently. They're actually both orbiting a center of mass, so they both are orbiting.
Right, yeah, about the center of mass. Is it the case that in these 27 cases, the living star is more massive than the black hole?
No, usually not. Usually the living star is lower mass than the black hole. So the black hole is usually 5 or 10 times the mass of the sun. This is maybe 1, 2, or 3 times the mass of the sun.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, thank you for that talk. That was really great. Mm-hmm. And I know your focus is on stellar mass black holes, but you showed us a lovely little simulated animation of Sagittarius A star. So mm-hmm. I have a question about supermassive black holes.
Sure.
In the center of galaxies. For those who don't know, that's the supermassive black hole in the center of this galaxy. So the Event Horizon Telescope, which is a kind of giant virtual Earth-sized telescope, has taken some lovely pictures of Sagittarius A star on a different one. Is how does your technology kind of complementary for that, and what can we learn about supermassive galactic center black holes using your technology that we weren't able to learn using the Event Horizon Telescope?
Yeah, so the Event Horizon Telescope is an incredible machine or series of machines, array of machines across the Earth. It's only able to measure and resolve and take images of the shadows of exactly two black holes. One is the closest one, supermassive black hole, that's in our own galaxy, and the other is the most massive one in the nearby universe that we know of, which is M87. So everything else is too far away or too small for even that telescope to resolve, because they're trying to resolve what's happening right almost at the event horizon, right? That material that just before it passes across the event horizon falls in and glows, and that's what they're probing. For this technique of gravitational lensing, we are talking about now stellar mass black holes that are way smaller than these supermassive black holes. Could you use the same technique for a supermassive black hole? Maybe, but the problem is galaxies are a lot messier than this very simple black hole star system we're studying. The supermassive black holes have gas around them. They have a whole galaxy's worth of background stars behind them. That makes it much, much harder to interpret any gravitational lensing that we might see. All that being said, we are trying. So I also work on the galactic center, our own galactic center, and we are starting to think about, can we see gravitational lensing effects from our own supermassive black hole?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm very fascinated by the binary black hole versus the free floating black hole. My understanding is because of our limitation in the measurement method, so we measure much less numbers for the free floating ones than the binary ones. So my question is there any understanding on the formation process of the binary black holes? Do they come from free floating black holes capturing a living star, turning to that so we can observe? In that regard, do they then later, after absorbing all the living star and turning to a free floating black hole again, have we made any observation relating to that? Thank you.
You've hit spot on all the uncertainty that we don't know about binary black holes, which makes them fun to study, but tough to interpret and extrapolate to the whole universe. So we don't actually know how these binaries form and get so close together. How do you get a black hole and a star forming that close? Because the black hole, when it was alive and it was a star, it's usually bigger than the separation between the two right now. So I think our current understanding is that probably both things happen. They probably form apart and then dynamically become binaries, and some of them started and were born as binaries. What fraction that is entirely uncertain. It's very, very challenging for us to understand. And we're still in the phase where stars dumping mass on each other when they have binary companions. We don't know what happens to the stars when that occurs. There's a lot of computational physics being done to try and simulate these situations in nature right now and understand what would happen. That will help a lot, and then just a lot more observations as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good.
I'm curious about the practical matters of using these wonderful instruments. So how much time do you take in an observing session to get this data? How often do you need to get the data? And do you get as much observing time as you'd ideally like?
Great questions, yeah. So for the brightening effects, we need a dedicated telescope looking all the time, every minute, every night. Really, they need to look every night for the black holes. Regularly, the same patch of the sky. And we have a few such facilities, but not a lot. For the astrometry, the position measurements, we use Hubble or Keck. We're typically using those a few times a year. And each time we do, it takes about 4 hours of observing. So it's not a lot of time, but the time is also extremely competitive, right? Every astronomer in the world wants to use Hubble or use Keck. So these telescopes are heavily oversubscribed. Hubble, it's like 10 to 1. So you can ask for 10 days of time and you'll get 1 day of time. Really, it's hours. You'll ask for 10 hours and you get 1 hour. So yeah, it's a very small amount of actual observing time, but it's enough that it's still really hard to get. And yes, we could use more, which is why we're excited for Roman. We have a whole survey dedicated to just microlensing to get the brightening and the position measurements.
Thank you.
I want to ask, is there an opportunity to use the synthetic aperture algorithms to resolve those 2 points? For example, if you have a Hubble, you will get effective diameter of your telescope like 2 Earth radius.
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a couple different angles to it. That light curve shape stuff that I was telling you about is mostly from the Earth moving around the Sun. So if you could put two telescopes at different points in the Earth's orbit and look at the microlensing event at the same time, you could measure that same shape effect. So that would be really fun, and we're trying to work on doing that now with a telescope on the Earth and a telescope far from Earth. So that's one way to do it. The other way is the Very Large Telescope in Chile that's run by the European Survey Observatories, that's ESO, sorry about that. So they have four ground-based telescopes that are just a little bit smaller than Keck. They can use all four at once to do what we call interferometry, and they have one case where they've resolved the two images of a microlensing event, they think. So the problem is the data quality was right on the edge, but they're going to try again this coming summer to get it again. Yeah,
it's exciting news. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. When you look at an image with multiple objects, how can you tell that it's because of the lensing effect, or they are actually from like separate objects?
Yeah, so we have to have that brightening and fading to know what we're looking at. The first time we did this experiment, we went to Keck and we looked at all these stars in the field where we had just a blurry image before and suddenly we had a sharp image and we didn't know which star we were supposed to look at. So we had to wait, and we waited and kept observing, and eventually one was fading away and we knew that was the one that was gravitationally lensing. So you're right, we do get confused about what the right star we are interested in is. But the signposts are there. If we hop on it soon enough, we can see that fade away in the brightening.
Okay, thank you. The information that you call the butterfly data, were there no contributions to that data from LISA?
So, it's a great question. So LISA is another gravitational wave facility that doesn't exist yet. It's a plan only. So we hope to build LISA, which would be a gravitational wave interferometer in space instead of on the ground. I will also say, though, that LISA is not really sensitive to the merging of stellar mass black holes. It's sensitive to the merging of supermassive black holes way out in the distant galaxy. So the ground-based gravitational wave facilities are the things that's going to keep populating this plot. I would say 10 years from now, we won't have 100 binary mergers. We'll have 1,000. It will continue to do great work. LISA will tell us about a totally new set of types of black holes and their mergers. Yeah.